Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the place that cuts through the noise to bring you the signal, really transforming complex information into clear, actionable understanding. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'll be your guide on this journey.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. I'm here to help connect the dots, look at the broader implications, and really, you know, unpack the deeper meaning behind the information we've gathered for you today.
Today, we're embarking on a really crucial deep dive. The title is The Federal News Update for Saturday, August 30th, 2025.
Right.
And our mission for you today is, well, it's singular, to give you a thorough, comprehensive, and frankly, an utterly exhaustive report on every single significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government. We're talking since the beginning of August 29, 2025.
Just a 4 to 8 hour window.
Exactly. And we're not just going to detail what happened, we're going to really discuss and debate the profound impact, the implications of each and every move.
Yeah, and what truly stands out, I think, from our sources is just how much significant activity can be packed into, like you said, just 48 hours. It's especially stark when you see the different branches of government pushing and pulling in such dramatic ways, sometimes really unprecedented ways.
Mm-hmm.
This specific period, it gives us a remarkably vivid snapshot. You know, the checks and balances in action.
Or sometimes inaction.
Yeah.
Which can be just as telling.
Exactly. Or the implications of their maybe strategic inaction.
Okay, let's start unpacking this then.
Yeah.
Our sources, they really lay bare a period of, well, profound friction. Lots of assertive action. We see the executive branch aggressively leveraging its authority, trying to push a really transformative agenda, often testing the very boundaries of its power, it seems.
And that assertion, it was met with formidable pushback, pretty swift pushback, actually, from the judicial branch. Within these 2 days, we saw two landmark appellate court rulings. And they directly challenged the administration's core strategies on international trade and on immigration.
Two huge areas.
Huge. And if you place this in a broader context, it's really a classic example of the judiciary reasserting its role, almost drawing a line in the sand, you know, against what it perceives as executive overreach.
Meanwhile, you've got Congress largely silent, a passive observer, really.
Yeah.
Which effectively created something of a power vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And this was most glaringly obvious in the administration's unprecedented use of what they're calling a pocket rescission.
Mm-hmm.
This move blocked $4.9 billion in foreign aid that Congress had already approved. Sam, this wasn't just like a political squabble over money.
No, no.
It felt like a tactical exploitation of the legislative calendar itself, a direct challenge to Congress's power of the purse.
That's absolutely right. It prompts us to ask, you know, what happens when one branch essentially goes quiet or is quiet?
Yeah.
Other branches, they often step in to fill that void. And we saw that here. But amidst all this, you know, high stakes constitutional conflict, the federal government's independent agencies, the cabinet departments, they just kept going.
Business as usual, in a way.
Sort of. Doing their methodical, often very technocratic work. Making moves that carry deep, lasting implications, even if those actions don't generate the same kind of headlines as a big court battle, they really provide this surprising layer of continuity amidst all the political maelstrom.
So for you, our listener, what this means is we're looking at a truly critical juncture. You've got this multi-front, aggressive effort by the executive.
Mm-hmm.
You have a judiciary firmly reasserting its role, pushing back. And then you have a legislature in a state of, well, strategic quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It really lays bare the stress on the American system of checks and balances. It's pushing fundamental constitutional questions right to the forefront, isn't it?
It really is.
All right, let's dive headfirst into the executive branch then, because it truly set the pace, the tone, during these 48 hours. Our sources show a coordinated, pretty aggressive strategy to implement the president's agenda, and often, it seems, deliberately bypassing the legislative process entirely.
Yeah, that's a key theme.
This period, it was characterized by, you know, executive orders, sweeping regulatory changes, and some incredibly novel, maybe even audacious interpretations of presidential fiscal authority. So for you listening, how does this begin to redefine the operational landscape of our government?
Okay, first up, let's talk about this incredible fiscal power play that unfolded. It was August 30th, 2025. The Trump administration executed a maneuver that, well, it represents a significant escalation in that ongoing power struggle, right? Between the executive and legislative branches over who controls federal spending.
Always a flashpoint.
Always. President Trump formally informed House Speaker Mike Johnson that he would not spend $4.9 billion in foreign aid. aid that had been previously appropriated by Congress. And this wasn't, you know, a request for Congress to maybe reconsider.
No, it was a statement of intent.
Exactly. A unilateral declaration, framed by the White House as a pocket rescission.
A very specific and controversial term. Let's break down the funds. This package of withheld money, it's substantial. And it seems strategically targeted. You've got $3.2 billion in development assistance grants, a huge $520 million for the United Nations, $838 million earmarked for international peacekeeping ops, and another $322 million meant to promote democratic values abroad. Now, this move, it lines up perfectly with a broader administration policy to, you know, cut back on foreign aid.
We've seen that trend.
Right. And it was echoed very openly by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He actually announced on social media that USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which for decades has been the main vehicle for America's soft power, right, delivering aid, development assistance globally.
A huge part of U.S. foreign policy.
He said USAID is now officially in closeout mode. So this isn't just trimming the budget. It feels like dismantling a core tool of U.S. global influence.
Yeah, closeout mode is strong language. And what really stands out here, Alex, is the administration's legal justification for this, because it hinges on this highly controversial interpretation of the Impoundment Control Act of 1974.
Okay, remind us about that act.
Right. So this law, if you recall, it was passed specifically to stop presidents from unilaterally refusing to spend money appropriated by Congress. Nixon was famous for doing that.
Impoundment, right.
Exactly. The act allows a president to propose a rescission, propose cutting funds, but, and this is crucial, it requires Congress to approve that rescission within 45 days. If Congress doesn't act, the president is legally obligated to spend the money, period.
So how does the pocket rescission argument work then?
Well, the White House is essentially arguing this. By proposing these cuts so close to the end of the fiscal year, September 30th is the deadline, the 45-day review period becomes, well, moot. It's irrelevant. They're arguing the funds would simply lapse, they'd expire, before Congress could even theoretically respond, especially since they were in recess.
So using the calendar.
Precisely. If you zoom out a bit, this is, it's an unprecedented attempt to get around a cornerstone of congressional oversight. It's almost like a legal sleight of hand designed purely to exploit a procedural timing window.
Okay, this is where the plot really thickens, I think. Because this tactic, it feels like a deliberate exploitation of the legislative calendar itself. It was done while Congress was in recess, only conducting these brief symbolic pro forma sessions, making a real legislative response impossible within that 45-day window.
They couldn't have responded substantively.
Right. It's like they found a strategic loophole and just drove a truck right through it, deliberately manufacturing a situation where Congress physically could not fulfill its statutory role. So it's not just a policy disagreement about foreign aid level.
No, it's much deeper.
It feels like a fundamental challenge to Congress's constitutional power of the purse. If this maneuver is allowed to stand, think about the precedent. It could effectively grant the executive a line item veto, something presidents have wanted for years, over any appropriation they don't like, as long as they time it right, maybe late August.
It potentially renders the whole appropriations process, all those bipartisan deals, largely symbolic, if the president can just undo it later.
Exactly. Any deal Congress makes could just be wiped out.
Yeah. And this isn't just a squabble over funding levels. It's a battle over foundational principles, the separation of powers. And the move drew immediate, sharp, bipartisan condemnation from Congress. You had Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, calling it a clear violation of the law and a usurpation of congressional authority.
Strong words from a Republican.
Very. And on the other side, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer warned that it undermines the very foundation of budget negotiations. He argued it dramatically increases the risk of a government shutdown down the line, because why would you negotiate in good faith if the president can just withhold spending later?
Right. Future agreements lose their teeth.
Precisely. It really prompts us to ask, how much power can one branch unilaterally claim before the system itself starts to, you know, fundamentally break down? This conflict, it's now poised to become a major constitutional crisis. It's almost certainly heading for the federal courts to sort out.
Okay, so for you, our listener, what's the practical implication here? Beyond the domestic power struggle, this action sends a deeply destabilizing signal to the international community. If you're an ally of the U.S., you might rightly be wondering if promises from the U.S. government, even funding approved by Congress, are really worth the paper they're printed on.
It introduces a huge element of unpredictability.
Yeah, it suggests U.S. commitments aren't guaranteed. they might be subject to the immediate political whims of the president. That really undermines diplomatic credibility and the reliability of the United States as a global partner. It creates this huge ripple effect globally, making U.S. foreign policy look unpredictable, maybe less trustworthy. Hashtag 1.2, foreign policy and national security posture. Now, at the same time as this challenge to congressional spending, the executive branch was also pursuing a pretty robust foreign policy agenda. This seemed centered on strengthening key military alliances, mostly through major arms sales and also brokering some regional diplomatic agreements.
A sort of two-pronged approach.
Yeah, and this dual approach, it really reflects a kind of transactional realist worldview, doesn't it? Prioritizing hard power, tangible security pacts, or maybe more traditional forms of engagement like that aid we just discussed.
Mm-hmm. The contrast is stark.
So on August 29th, the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, that's DSCA, they notified Congress of several significant proposed foreign military sales, FMS. These are greenlit by the State Department. A key package was for Ukraine, valued at about $179.1 million. It provides for the sustainment of their critical Patriot air defense systems.
Very important for their defense right now.
Absolutely. It includes essential spare parts, maintenance, software updates, training, everything needed to keep those systems effective against ongoing threats. There was another approved sale for Ukraine, too, an additional $150 million in satellite communication services. So together, these sales really underscore a continued U.S. commitment to boosting Ukraine's defense capabilities.
Right. Despite the aid cuts elsewhere, military support continues there.
Then, in a move of even greater scale, the administration approved a possible $8.5 billion FMS to Denmark. That's for an integrated battle command system-enabled Patriot missile defense system. IBCS-enabled Patriot.
That's a huge upgrade.
Massive. For a key NATO ally, right there on the eastern flank, it signals a strong commitment to collective defense and deterrence in Europe. And the principal contractors here, no surprise, major U.S. defense firms. RTX Corporation, formerly Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin.
Big money for the defense industry.
Definitely. Now, while pushing these hard power initiatives, the administration was also doing some high-level diplomacy. On that same day, August 29th, the State Department published the finalized documents from that pretty historic August 8th meeting between President Trump, Azerbaijani President Aliyev, and Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan.
The Caucasus peace effort.
Exactly. The release included a joint declaration by the two leaders, plus several memorandum of understanding, MOUs, between the U.S. and those nations individually, covering things like energy security, AI, semiconductor innovation. The stated aim is a new era of peace in the South Caucasus and building strategic partnerships on these key tech and energy issues.
Okay, so taken together, this whole set of actions, it reveals a distinct foreign policy doctrine, doesn't it? What really stands out is that stark juxtaposition, as you said earlier. You've got these hard power initiatives, big arms sales, direct diplomatic deals right alongside the proposed dismantling of foreign aid, the pocket rescission, the USA closeout.
Yeah, the contrast is jarring.
Putting this in a broader context, it's a clear signal, I think, that this administration prioritizes military strength and direct, often bilateral or trilateral, agreements over traditional soft power and multilateral development. Now, this shift, it might be welcomed by military allies looking for advanced hardware.
Sure.
But it forces us to ask, what are the long-term consequences of systematically dismantling U.S. soft power infrastructure, like USAID, an agency that's been a pillar of global influence for decades? What happens when that goes away?
The long-term consequences could be really profound for you, our listener, and for global dynamics generally. It risks creating this vacuum in global development.
Yeah.
And that vacuum will likely be filled, right?
Yeah.
Probably by other global powers, maybe China in particular.
That's the concern.
This could potentially erode decades of U.S. influence in places like Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia regions that have historically relied on U.S. aid for critical programs in health, education, stability. So why should this matter to you? Well, beyond the headlines, this signals a potential major realignment of global influence. If you care about American leadership on the world stage, this is a really significant development. It bears close watching because it could reshape geopolitical alliances and global aid landscapes for decades to come. Hashtag 1.3, domestic policy implementation and regulatory agenda. Okay, let's shift our focus now to domestic policy implementation and the regulatory agenda. Across the federal bureaucracy, cabinet departments, agencies, they were actively implementing the administration's domestic agenda on August 29th. These actions, they span social welfare, finance, environmental regulation, law enforcement.
A wide range.
A very wide range. And they seem to illustrate this whole of government effort. It's characterized by, I'd say, three main themes. First, deregulation, offered by devolving power to the states. Second, using federal programs to influence social behavior. And third, aggressive legal challenges to state-level policies that conflicts with the administration's priorities.
Yeah, those three themes really capture it.
So let's look at social welfare first. The USDA's Food and Nutrition Service, they issued new guidance for implementing a part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act of 2025. This guidance significantly changes how energy assistance payments affect eligibility for SNP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps.
How so?
Okay, think of it this way. Previously, if you got help with your heating bill through LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, you might automatically qualify for an extra allowance in your SNAP benefits to help cover utility costs. It was called the Standard Utility Allowance, or SUA.
Right, it boosted the benefit.
Exactly. But under these new rules, households getting LIHEAP payments will no longer automatically qualify for that heating and cooling SUA. There's an exception. Unless the household includes an elderly or disabled member. This change, which has to be applied immediately to new applicants, represents a clear tightening of eligibility for a key benefit that helps low-income families. It just makes it harder for some folks to access full SNAP support.
So potentially reducing benefits for some families?
Potentially, yes. And this action seems philosophically aligned with another initiative, the Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA initiative. This is championed by HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services. On August 29th, HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was actually in Austin, Texas, with Governor Greg Abbott. They were celebrating the passage of the state's Make Texas Healthy Again Act.
So states mirroring the federal agenda.
Precisely. This state law mirrors the federal MAHA agenda. It promotes food label transparency, puts nutrition education in schools, and, maybe most notably, it prohibits using SNAP benefits to buy sweetened drinks and candy.
That's a significant restriction on SNAP usage.
It is. And it's a big philosophical shift, isn't it? It's moving social welfare beyond just, you know, providing basic assistance. It's aggressively trying to shape personal health and dietary choices. And this next detail is quite revealing because it shows the federal government using its programs not just for aid, but to influence individual behavior, aiming for a specific, almost mandated vision of public health.
Using the power of the purse to shape lifestyle choices.
Seems like it. Okay, shifting to the economic front. The Treasury Department announced its current estimates for borrowing. They projected needing to borrow a substantial $1.007 trillion in privately held net marketable debt for the third quarter of 2025, July through September.
$1 trillion. That's a lot of borrowing.
It is. Treasury also moved forward on regulating digital assets. They issued a request for comment related to that Genius Act, the Guiding and Establishing National Innovation for U.S. Stablecoins Act. They're seeking public input on methods to detect illicit activity involving digital assets like stablecoins.
So laying groundwork for future regulation there.
Exactly. Now, environmental policy. Here, the administration advanced its agenda of deregulation and federalism. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin went to Wyoming. He announced the proposed approval of Wyoming's application to manage its own coal combustion residuals, or CCR, permit program. CCR is basically coal ash.
So giving states control over regulating coal ash disposal.
Right. This move would transfer regulatory authority from the federal EPA to the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. It's a key goal of the administration's cooperative federalism approach, empowering states to oversee industries within their borders. Proponents argue this gives regulatory certainty, might stimulate investment, let states tailor rules to local conditions. Critics worry it could lead to weaker environmental protections.
It's the classic federal versus state control debate.
It is. And finally, the Department of Justice, DOJ, was active too. They announced a new cross-agency trade fraud task force partnering with Homeland Security. The aim is squarely cracking down on companies or individuals trying to evade tariffs and import duties.
Consistent with the administration's focus on trade enforcement.
Yes. And in another move highlighting that clash with progressive state policies, DOJ filed a motion for summary judgment in its legal challenge against New York's Climate Change Superfund Act. The DOJ argues that the New York law, which tries to make energy companies pay for climate change damages, is unconstitutional state overreach and directly conflicts with federal energy policy.
So using federal power to preempt state climate action.
Seems to be the goal.
Okay, if you pull back and look at all these domestic actions together, what really stands out is how coherent the administration's domestic strategy is. Even though the actions are diverse across many agencies and policy areas.
Right, there's a clear pattern.
There is. They're empowering states that align with them, like Texas on MAHA or Wyoming on CCR. They're challenging states that don't, like New York on climate. And they're using the administrative agencies, the bureaucracy, to implement a specific social vision across the country, like with the SNAP changes. Mm-hmm. Placing this in broader context, it really deepens political polarization, doesn't it? It turns federal-state relations into this battleground for cultural and ideological issues, not just, you know, straightforward policy implementation. Which prompts us to ask, what kind of regulatory landscape does this create for businesses, for citizens? When policies can shift so dramatically based on who's in power, and when states become instruments in a broader ideological conflict rather than just, say, laboratories of democracy.
That's a great question. And for you, the listener, the practical implication is significant. If you're running a business, it creates really complex, often uncertain regulatory environment.
Right.
You might have federal and state policies pulling in opposite directions.
Yeah.
Requires careful navigation. If you rely on social welfare programs, or even if you just care about environmental policy, these actions directly impact your life and your state's autonomy. They determine how resources get distributed, how environmental protections are enforced. It really underscores how deeply intertwined these federal actions are with our daily lives. They reach right into our grocery baskets, the air we breathe, the energy we use, hashtag 1.4. White House communications and cultural messaging.
Mm.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to how the White House communicates all this, how it shapes its cultural messaging. Because the administration's public communications on and around August 29th, they seem very carefully curated. They're constructing a specific narrative about its values, its priorities.
Messaging is always key.
Always. And this messaging, pushed out through official proclamations, video releases, new initiatives, it focused heavily on populist themes, cultural themes, designed to resonate with the president's base and shape public perception. Often, in ways that stood in really stark contrast to the complex legal and policy battles we've just been talking about.
Setting a different tone publicly.
Exactly. A central theme was championing the American worker. In anticipation of Labor Day, the White House put out a series of videos, cabinet members sharing stories of their first jobs, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt detailing President Trump's, quote, pro-worker accomplishments.
Standard pre-holiday messaging, perhaps.
Well, yes, but it was anchored by a formal presidential proclamation for Labor Day, issued August 29th, dated August 28th. And the proclamation, it frames the administration as the defender of American labor against a corrupt political class that supposedly let jobs be shipped overseas. It credits the president with restoring the dignity of labor, bringing jobs back to America.
Okay.
Now, here's where the timing gets really interesting. This robust pro-worker messaging was deployed on the very same day that a federal appellate court declared the administration's signature pro-worker policy, those sweeping tariffs, to be illegal.
The juxtaposition again.
Right. It feels like a clear attempt to control the public narrative, to preempt the negative news coverage about the tariff ruling by focusing on this consistent preferred story about being pro-worker.
Using offense as the best defense, message-wise.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Another key messaging event revolved around Women's Equality Day. The White House issued a presidential message on August 26th, commemorating the 105th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage. The message emphasized the God-given dignity of the human person and fulfilling America's founding principles.
Okay, a standard commemoration. Or is there more context?
Well, let's connect it to the broader context of the administration's policy.
Yeah.
Particularly that executive order from January 2025. The title was Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government.
Right, I remember that order.
That order explicitly defined sex as an immutable biological classification. It directed federal agencies to remove materials promoting gender ideology. So with that backdrop, the Women's Equality Day message wasn't just a historical nod. It felt like a subtle yet potent reinforcement of a specific and quite controversial ideological stance on gender, a stance with direct policy implications for agencies like HHS, which was directed to remove that gender ideology content from educational materials. So it prompts us to ask, how is language carefully used here? To subtly reinforce specific ideological stances, weaving them into even seemingly innocuous public statements? And what are the long-term effects on public discourse and policy when that happens?
It's about using seemingly neutral events to advance a specific viewpoint.
Exactly. And finally, the White House also engaged in a sort of soft power initiative through the First Lady's office. On August 26th, First Lady Melania Trump launched the Presidential Artificial Intelligence Challenge. It's a nationwide competition for K-12 students. The idea is for them to use AI to solve problems in their communities.
An interesting initiative.
Yeah, citing her own experience using AI to create the audiobook for her memoir, Mrs. Trump positioned this as empowering the next generation, ensuring America leads in this critical technology. It's forward-looking, it's non-controversial, it provides a positive counterpoint to some of the administration's more combative actions elsewhere. And it serves to engage a younger demographic on a topic of broad national interest.
A bit of positive PR amidst the conflict.
So for you, the listener, what's the crucial takeaway here? I think it's this. This sophisticated communication strategy demonstrates a real understanding that public perception is a critical battleground. The administration operates this messaging apparatus that often seems to decouple its narrative from the substantive legal realities of its policies.
The narrative versus the facts on the ground.
Right. The goal appears to be building a brand, a direct relationship with supporters that's resilient. Resilient to unfavorable court rulings, critical media reports. It means you have to be extra vigilant, really discerning what's actually happening versus what's being said about what's happening, because the narrative itself is clearly being used as a powerful political tool.
And this contributes significantly, I think, to the erosion of a shared factual basis in public discourse. The success of an agenda can become dependent less on its empirical validity, you know, whether it actually works or is legal, and more on its ability to maintain a strong preferred narrative, even when confronted with conflicting evidence or legal setbacks. That's a profound shift in how political power is exercised and sustained. And it has deep implications for the future of democratic debate, doesn't it?
It really does. A profound shift indeed. Okay, now let's pivot. Let's turn to the judicial coach. Because while the executive was pushing the envelope with these aggressive actions, the courts were pushing back, decisively in some cases. On August 29th, federal appellate courts delivered two powerful rebukes. They constrained the president's unilateral authority in those critical areas, international trade and immigration.
Two major rulings on the same day.
Exactly. These are landmark rulings, folks. They represent a formidable reassertion of the judiciary's role as a check on executive power. And they really set the stage for major constitutional confrontations, likely at the Supreme Court. All right, first, the big one on trade. In a decision with truly profound implications for U.S. economic and foreign policy, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled that President Trump had exceeded his legal authority, specifically in imposing those sweeping tariffs on a wide range of imports.
This is the core of the America First trade strategy.
It absolutely is. This 7-4 ruling strikes right at the heart of the administration's trade agenda, which has relied so heavily on unilateral import taxes as its main tool for coercion for negotiation. This decision essentially legally dismantles the primary mechanism the president has used to wage his trade wars in his second term. It's a game changer. It fundamentally alters the administration's strategic toolkit.
So what was the legal basis for the challenge?
The court's decision centered on the president's use of IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, to justify these tariffs. The administration had declared the nation's persistent trade deficit a national emergency.
A controversial declaration in itself.
Very. And by declaring that emergency, they claimed authority under IEP to regulate imports. And they interpreted regulate to include the power to just set tariffs unilaterally.
A broad interpretation of regulate.
Extremely broad. And the court squarely rejected it. The majority opinion stated pretty clearly, quote, "It seems unlikely that Congress intended to grant the president unlimited authority to impose tariffs. The ruling found the statute, IEPA, does not explicitly grant the power to impose taxes or duties."
So Congress didn't spell it out.
Exactly. And crucially, the court also noted that IEPA lacked the kind of procedural safeguards you'd normally expect when Congress delegates such a significant power, the power to tax, essentially to the executive. The court was basically saying, look, for such a massive power grab, Congress would have had to spell it out much more clearly and probably put in more checks and balances.
Interesting. So which tariffs did this invalidate?
Good question. The ruling specifically invalidates two major sets. First, those reciprocal tariffs up to 50% imposed back in April 2025 on nearly all U.S. trading partners. Second, levies imposed in February 2025 against China, Mexico, and Canada. Those were justified by a separate national emergency declaration related to cross-border drug flows.
Okay, so broad impact. But does it affect all Trump-era tariffs?
No, and that's important. The decision does not affect other tariffs imposed under different legal authorities. The main example is the Section 232 national security tariffs on steel and aluminum. Those remain in place based on a different law.
Got it. So what happens now? Are the tariffs gone?
Not immediately. Recognizing the huge disruptive potential of its decision, the appellate court very prudently put its own ruling on hold. That gives the administration time to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which they almost certainly will do.
So limbo for now, but heading to the Supreme Court.
Exactly. But this ruling, even on hold, creates massive legal and economic uncertainty. Think about it. The federal government has collected hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue from these now invalidated tariffs.
Wow.
The Justice Department itself warned the court that a final ruling against the administration could force the Treasury to issue refunds. That's a potentially enormous fiscal blow. Could have widespread impact across the economy.
Billions in refunds. That's huge.
Huge. Furthermore, the decision immediately changes the game in international trade negotiations. U.S. trading partners think the EU, with whom the administration had just announced a new trade framework, they now have significant new leverage.
Because the tariff threat is weakened?
Precisely. They know the president's biggest stick, the ability to impose unilateral tariffs at will, now rests on a very precarious legal foundation. This might force the administration back toward more traditional methods of trade negotiation, methods sanctioned by Congress. It could fundamentally alter the strategic approach to global commerce, maybe even cool down some trade tensions.
Okay. What truly stands out here, Alex, is the court's careful delineation of presidential emergency powers. This isn't just about tariffs or trade policy. Placing this in a broader context, it's a landmark decision on the separation of powers in the 21st century. The Supreme Court is now going to be asked to define the outer limits of presidential emergency powers, especially in the realm of economic and foreign policy. That ruling will have consequences for decades, which prompts us to ask, how will the Supreme Court balance executive flexibility, particularly when a president declares an emergency, with fundamental congressional authority, the power of the purse, and the rule of law? It's a tension as old as the Republic, isn't it? Now playing out on this modern economic stage.
It really is. And for you, our listener, this means a significant shakeup. If you're a consumer, the potential for tariff refunds or even just a shift in trade policy could directly affect the prices you pay for imported goods. Everything from electronics to cars to clothes.
It could mean lower prices eventually.
Or maybe higher prices if uncertainty continues. If you're a business, this creates massive uncertainty in your supply chains, in international agreements. It makes planning for the future incredibly difficult, forces you to recalculate costs, maybe rethink strategies. It's a huge disruption with very tangible impacts across the entire economy. Okay, now for the second major judicial check on executive authority from that day. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously blocked the Trump administration's plan to terminate temporary protected status, or TPS, for roughly 600,000 Venezuelans living in the United States.
Another significant ruling.
Very significant. This ruling upholds a lower court injunction. It provides a crucial, though potentially temporary, reprieve for this large immigrant population. They were facing the imminent loss of their legal right to live and work here.
And what was the administration's reasoning for ending TPS for Venezuelans?
Well, it was part of that broader policy push to reduce both legal and illegal immigration. The Department of Homeland Security, under Secretary Kristi Noem, had argued that conditions back in Venezuela had improved enough to allow for the safe return of its nationals.
Okay, so they argued conditions on the ground had changed.
They did. But, interestingly, the Ninth Circuit's decision didn't really hinge on the conditions in Venezuela itself.
Oh. What did they focus on then?
The three-judge panel focused narrowly on the process and the statutory authority of the Homeland Security Secretary. The court found that the plaintiffs, the ones challenging the termination, were likely to succeed in their claim that the secretary actually lacked the authority to simply vacate or set aside a prior existing extension of TPS.
So a procedural and authority argument, not about Venezuela itself.
Exactly. The panel's reasoning, written by Judge Kim Wardlaw, was quite pointed. She wrote that Congress, when it created the TPS program back in the Immigration Act of 1990, designed a system of temporary status that was predictable, dependable, and insulated from electoral politics.
Strong language. Predictable, dependable, insulated from politics.
Very strong. The judges emphasized that the guaranteed time limits within the TPS statute were critical. They allow recipients to find stable employment, secure housing, without fearing sudden, maybe politically motivated, policy shifts. This language, it really serves as a direct, if maybe implicit, rebuke of the administration's approach. The court seemed to characterize it as driven by political considerations rather than the strict requirements of the law.
So the court is saying Congress intended stability in this program.
That seems to be the message. And for you, the listener, this ruling has immediate, profound human consequences. For hundreds of thousands of individuals, this decision is truly a lifeline. It offers a measure of certainty in what have been deeply uncertain times for them. Many had reportedly already been fired from jobs or were facing detention and deportation because their status was set to expire.
A huge relief for those families.
Absolutely. This ruling offers stability, at least for now. Allows them to remain with their families, continue working, contributing to their communities while the legal battle goes on. It really reminds us of the profound human impact of these policy decisions and the critical role the courts sometimes play in protecting individuals caught in the middle.
Yeah, the human element is crucial here. Mm-hmm. And what really stands out, legally speaking, is the court's emphasis on congressional intent and the statutory process, rather than getting into a debate about the conditions in Venezuela. Placing this in broader context, it reinforces the judiciary's role as a protector of statutory processes. It ensures executive discretion stays within the bounds set by Congress. It's a powerful reminder, I think, that if the executive branch wants to make permanent, sweeping changes to immigration law, it ultimately has to engage with the legislative branch, the branch that actually writes those laws, rather than trying to act unilaterally through administrative decisions. Which prompts us to ask, does this ruling effectively narrow the executive's ability to use discretion in immigration matters overall? Or does it simply force a more transparent, more legally sound process, one that adheres more closely to congressional intent, ultimately maybe pushing major policy changes back into the legislative arena where they arguably belong?
That's the key question going forward, isn't it? Okay, so while the executive and judicial branches were locked in these high-stakes confrontations shaping the future of American policy, our sources show the legislative branch, well, it was largely silent.
Conspicuously absent from the drama.
Right. It was a period of near total lack of substantive activity. Congress basically acted as a bystander during moments of incredibly consequential governance. Now, here's the real kicker. This legislative paralysis, it isn't just an absence of action. It's actually a critical contextual factor. It enables, maybe even encourages, aggressive executive action. And it profoundly shifts the balance of power. #, #, #3.1. Pro forma sessions and the implications of legislative inactivity. Let's look at the details. On Friday, August 29th, 2025, both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate convened for what are called pro forma sessions. These lasted only minutes. The House met at 1:30 p.m., did the pledge, approved the journal from the day before, and boom, adjourned at 1:31 p.m. Not scheduled to reconvene until September 2nd.
Just going through the motions.
Totally. Similarly, the Senate convened at 7 a.m. for a session of comparable brevity, then adjourned. And there was zero floor activity in any other chamber on Saturday, August 30th.
So basically, Congress was out of town.
Pretty much. During this entire period, no committee hearings were held. No legislative business was conducted. And crucially, no votes were taken on any substantive matters at all. The next scheduled substantive business for the Senate wasn't until September 2nd, a motion on the annual defense authorization bill. House committees weren't scheduled to meet until September 3rd for hearings on things like AI and healthcare.
Okay, so why even have these pro forma sessions if nothing happens?
Good question. They serve a constitutional purpose. Technically, they prevent the president from making recess appointments, appointing officials without Senate confirmation while Congress is formally adjourned. And they technically keep Congress in session, avoiding adjournment sine die, which means without assigning a day for a further meeting.
So a formality to preserve certain powers.
Exactly. But they are largely devoid of legislative substance. The practical effect is that for basically the entire month of August, Congress has been largely absent from Washington and effectively unable to act as a co-equal branch of government in real time.
And that absence has consequences.
Direct and immediate consequences. Remember, that $4.9 billion pocket rescission of foreign aid we talked about. The administration's decision to announce it at the end of August was almost certainly strategically timed to coincide precisely with this period of congressional inaction.
They knew Congress couldn't respond.
Right. The administration's entire legal argument for the validity of that pocket rescission rests on the premise that Congress is procedurally unable to respond within the 45-day window set by the Impoundment Control Act. So the pro forma status isn't just a passive backdrop here. It's the key vulnerability the administration actively exploited to push its agenda. It's a classic, almost textbook example of legislative inactivity enabling unilateral executive action.
Yeah, what truly stands out here is how this legislative vacuum isn't just an absence of action, it's an active force shaping the power dynamics within our government. You've got an agile, determined executive branch able to act decisively through its huge administrative apparatus, setting and implementing policy in real time. And in contrast, you have a slow, often fractured, and in this case, physically absent legislative branch. It's frequently unable to mount a timely or effective response. Placing this in broader context, this dynamic has a corrosive effect, doesn't it, on the institution of Congress itself and on public perception of its role and relevance. When major court rulings come down, significant foreign policy decisions are made, sweeping domestic regulations are put in place, all while Congress is out of session, its authority is diminished.
Its relevance seems to shrink.
Exactly. Which prompts us to ask, what are the long-term implications for our system of checks and balances if Congress consistently yields the initiative to the other branches? If it effectively allows them to define the policy landscape without meaningful, timely legislative input or oversight?
And for you, the listener, this highlights a real challenge in modern governance. It means that during critical periods, your elected representatives might not be actively participating in shaping policy. They might be out of the loop, leaving monumental decisions to be hashed out between the executive and judicial branches. This structural imbalance, where the pace of executive action often just outstrips the legislative process, can have lasting effects on how laws are made, how our government operates, and potentially shifts power away from the people's direct representatives in Congress.
A concerning trend for representative democracy.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Let's move away from the high-stakes political drama for a moment and look at the often overlooked but incredibly important work of the independent agencies. Because beneath the surface of all that conflict, all that constitutional wrestling, these entities just kept plugging away, doing their substantive technocratic work with methodical purpose.
The machinery of government keeps turning.
It does. And this next detail is quite revealing because it shows a different, equally vital side of American governance, one that provides a surprising measure of continuity, of stability, even amidst intense political turmoil. All right, first up, the Federal Reserve. On August 29th, the Fed's Board of Governors announced the final individual capital requirements for the nation's largest banks. These new requirements are set to take effect October 1st, 2025. Now, this annual exercise, it's a cornerstone of the post-financial crisis regulatory framework.
Dodd-Frank aftermath, basically.
Exactly. It's designed to ensure that the CFIs, the systemically important financial institutions, those too-big-to-fail banks, hold enough capital to absorb losses during a severe economic downturn. The whole point is to avoid needing another taxpayer bailout like in 2008.
So making sure they have enough cushion.
Precisely. These requirements, they come from the results of the Fed's annual stress tests. Those tests subject banks to hypothetical, really harsh recession scenarios. Think of Common Equity Tier 1 Capital, CET1, as a bank's ultimate safety net. It's the money it has on hand that's truly its own, not borrowed.
The highest quality capital.
Right. The total CET1 requirement for each bank is a composite figure. It includes a baseline 4.5% minimum requirement, plus a stress capital buffer, or SCB, which is at least 2.5%, but varies based on how each bank performed in the stress test. And then there's an additional surcharge for firms designated as G-SIBs, global systemically important banks. Those are the truly massive international players. So this whole setup basically dictates how much cash they need to have on hand to withstand a major financial storm.
A complex calculation, but crucial for stability.
Very. Now, in a statement accompanying the announcement, Federal Reserve Vice Chair for Supervision, Michelle Bowman, described the current process as being in a period of transition.
Transition to what?
She's referring to a rule proposed back in April 2025. That rule would average a bank's stress test results over two consecutive years to calculate its SCB, that stress capital buffer. The idea is to reduce the year-over-year volatility in capital requirements, make it smoother, allow banks to plan more effectively with more certainty.
Less whiplash year to year.
Exactly. The final requirements announced for this year, for most banks, were actually flat or even lower than the previous year. That reflects a strong performance by the banks on the 2025 stress tests. One little wrinkle. The final requirement from Morgan Stanley was withheld. They requested a reconsideration of their SCB, And the Fed expects to make a decision on that by September 30th.
Okay. Can you give us a sense of what these requirements look like for specific banks?
Sure. Let's look at a few big ones. JP Morgan Chase & Co., their total CET1 requirement is 11.5%. That breaks down as 4.5% minimum plus a 2.5% stress buffer plus a 4.5% G-SIB surcharge because they're huge globally.
Okay.
Citigroup Inc. is at 11.6%. That's 4.5% minutes, a 3.6% stress buffer, and a 3.5% G-SIB surcharge. Then you have someone like DB USA Corporation, that's Deutsche Bank's U.S. holding company, at a much higher 16.0%. That's driven by a really significant 11.5% stress capital buffer. Shows the tests found higher potential losses for them under stress.
It really varies based on the bank's risk profile and activities.
Absolutely. And just a note for the real financial nerds listening. For some banks, their SCB requirements were based on their 2024 stress test results, maybe if they didn't participate fully in the most recent test. So there's some complexity there.
Got it.
Now, as the Fed was solidifying these rules, its economic forecasting models kept running too. The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta's GDP Now model, it's a widely watched real-time indicator, it updated its estimate for third quarter 2025 real GDP growth. And the estimate was a pretty robust 3.5%.
So, indicating a fairly strong economy despite all the political turbulence.
Seems so.
Okay, what truly stands out here, Alex, is how the Federal Reserve operates. It's on this purely technocratic, data-driven basis, largely insulated, at least in theory, from the intense political pressures we were just discussing with the other branches. Its process, looking ahead, setting these requirements, provides a crucial degree of predictability for the economy's most critical institutions.
Yeah, it feels like an anchor.
It does. Placing this in broader context, the Fed acts as this crucial force for stability, for continuity in the financial system, right in the midst of intense political turmoil. In a period of such intense polarization, the credibility and the independence of institutions like the Fed, they serve as a crucial ballast for the U.S. economy, which leads us to ask, in a highly polarized environment, just how vital is the sustained credibility and independence of institutions like the Fed, not just for economic stability, but for maintaining public trust in financial markets themselves?
That's a critical question. And for you, the listener, what this all means is these rules, these capital requirements, they help ensure the banks holding your money, managing your investments, providing loans for your house or car are stable. They help prevent the kind of systemic risks that led to past financial crises. It's a quiet function of government, maybe not very exciting.
Definitely not headline grabbing.
But it's absolutely essential. It provides predictability for our economy, protecting not just the big institutions, but every individual, every business within the financial system from major financial shocks. All right, look at another key independent agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. They were also active on August 29th, and their actions really reflect the dual nature of their mission. On one hand, managing the routine mechanics of market regulation. On the other, grappling with how to apply existing legal frameworks to new complex financial products, especially in that rapidly evolving digital asset space.
The crypto challenge.
Exactly. The bulk of the SEC's activity was, frankly, administrative and procedural. It's the essential day-to-day work needed for U.S. capital markets to function smoothly. The agency published multiple notices about rule changes filed by SROs, self-regulatory organizations like the NASDAQ stock market. They issued notices about applications from investment companies, Fidelity Private Credit Fund, DCW Direct Lending LLC, things like that.
The plumbing of the markets?
Pretty much. The SEC's Division of Enforcement also announced several administrative proceedings, litigation releases against various individuals and firms. That shows its ongoing role policing the markets for fraud, for other violations. And the steady flow of corporate filings continued too. Companies like Canopy Growth Corporation submitted a Form 8K to the SEC, announcing a new equity program. All standard stuff.
Okay, so the routine work continued. What about the innovation side?
Right. That's where it gets more interesting, with broader strategic implications. A notice published on August 28th revealed the commission was instituting proceedings, specifically to determine whether to approve or disapprove a proposed rule change to list and trade shares of something called the canary-staked TRX ETF.
Okay, an ETF involving crypto staking. What's significant about that?
This next detail is quite revealing. The action is highly significant because instead of just issuing a quick approval or disapproval, the SEC chose a more deliberative path. They're seeking public comment, allowing for additional analysis. This signals the agency is proceeding with extreme caution when it comes to exchange-traded products, ETFs, that involve crypto asset staking.
Why is staking so tricky for them?
Well, staking, where investors essentially lock up their crypto assets to help support a blockchain network, and they get rewards in return, raises really complex legal and policy questions. Are the underlying assets securities? How should they be custodied? How do you value them? How do you protect investors? The commission is clearly taking extensive time to consider all these angles carefully. This isn't a simple yes or no situation for the SEC. They're really digging in.
So, a slow, cautious approach to crypto ETFs with staking.
Very. And this methodical, almost case-by-case approach to crypto regulation by the SEC, it contrasts pretty sharply with the more proactive stance we're seeing at other agencies. Like the Treasury Department, remember? On August 29th, they issued that broad request for comment for the Genius Act, actively seeking input to build a whole new regulatory framework specifically for stablecoins.
Right. Treasury seems to be trying to build something new, while SEC applies existing rules.
Exactly. The SEC is largely working within its existing authorities, applying securities laws written decades ago to these new technologies. That's inherently a slower, more deliberate process.
Yeah.
And it's intensely focused on their primary mandate, investor protection.
Okay. What truly stands out here is these differing paces, these different methodologies within the federal government itself for regulating digital assets. You've got the SEC's cautious, principles-based approach applying old laws to new tech. That contrasts with Treasury's more proactive, maybe legislative-driven path trying to create new rules via the Genius Act. This fragmentation, it creates a degree of uncertainty for innovators in the digital asset industry, doesn't it?
For sure.
It can slow down the launch of new products. It can lead to a regulatory landscape defined more by enforcement actions and these lengthy review processes rather than clear, predefined rules of the road. And placing this in broader context, this fragmentation creates the potential for regulatory arbitrage where companies might try to structure things to operate in the perceived gaps between agencies' jurisdictions, maybe seeking the path of least resistance, which prompts us to ask, will this absence of a single coherent federal regulatory framework for digital assets ultimately intensify calls for comprehensive legislation from Congress to clarify the roles, the responsibilities of each agency? Or will it just remain this kind of patchwork approach for the foreseeable future?
That's the billion-dollar question for the crypto industry, isn't it? And for you, the listener, if you're an investor interested in new technologies like crypto, this means a slower, more complex path for bringing those innovations to the mainstream market. But the SEC would argue it's all being done in the name of investor protection. That's their core mission. It also means the future of crypto regulation is still very much being written. It's a dynamic space to watch, where clarity might emerge only very slowly. Okay, we've covered a huge amount of ground here, delving into the intense, intricate activities across the U.S. federal government in just, what, 48 hours? Now let's try to tie it all together. Let's consider what these events mean for the bigger picture and what they might suggest for the future. So after all that detail, what's the real takeaway? #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, #, period, it was undoubtedly that clash, right? Between a powerful executive branch seemingly determined to test the limits of its authority and a judicial branch resolved to enforce statutory and constitutional boundaries.
Yeah, that conflict was front and center.
The president's use of the pocket rescission on foreign aid, his reliance on emergency powers for tariffs, these represent a broad, aggressive interpretation of executive authority. Then, the appellate court rulings, striking down those tariffs, blocking the TPS termination for Venezuelans, those represent an equally forceful assertion of judicial review.
The court's pushing back hard.
And this conflict, it's taking place in an arena largely created by legislative inaction. We saw Congress's pro forma status effectively made it a non-participant, ceding the field to the other two branches to battle over these fundamental questions of power and policy.
The legislature as a spectator.
Pretty much. But this high-stakes political drama, it stands in a really stark contrast to the orderly, almost quiet technocratic functioning of the administrative state that we also saw. The Federal Reserve methodically implementing bank capital rules. The SEC deliberately reviewing new financial products. This showcases a totally different side of American governance.
Right, the part that just keeps working.
Yeah, one that's resilient, institutionalized, largely insulated from the day-to-day partisan warfare. So it presents this kind of bifurcated view, a split view of the U.S. government. It's simultaneously embroiled in these foundational conflicts that could threaten its stability while also possessing this deep administrative capacity that allows it to function to regulate a complex modern economy.
Yeah, what truly stands out there is that inherent tension. Between the chaotic political sphere and the orderly bureaucratic one, it really feels like a defining feature of the current moment, doesn't it? Highlighting how different parts of the government can operate on vastly different timelines with vastly different approaches to governing. Placing this in broader context, it suggests a system under immense stress, yes, but also one with remarkable resilience in its core functions, maintaining a surprising degree of continuity despite these intense external conflicts. It's a real paradox of American governance that I think merits deep consideration.
I agree. And for you, the listener, what this means is that even as the headlines are shouting about constitutional crises, about power struggles, important steady work is still being done behind the scenes by various agencies to keep the country running, to stabilize the financial system, ensure markets operate fairly. It's that paradox of modern governance, a government that is simultaneously in conflict and deeply functional, impacting your life in multiple, often unseen ways every single day. #TechTechTech 5.2, forward-looking analysis and strategic outlook. Now, the events of these 2 days, they're not really a conclusion, are they? They feel more like a prelude. A prelude to more intense, more consequential confrontations down the road.
Setting the stage for bigger battles.
Exactly. The key conflicts we identified over the president's spending power via rescission, his tariff authority under emergency statutes, his discretion in immigration matters, they're now on an almost certain trajectory toward the Supreme Court.
Seems inevitable.
The lower court rulings have already created circuit splits, meaning different appellate courts have issued conflicting opinions on similar legal questions. And they've raised fundamental questions about the separation of powers that really only the nation's highest court can resolve. The outcomes of these future Supreme Court cases, they will define the legal landscape of presidential power for a generation, potentially reshaping the balance between the branches for decades to come.
Huge stakes at the Supreme Court.
Huge. Now, for the administration, this presents a significant strategic risk. Its core policy agenda, particularly in trade and immigration, and its foundational governing strategy, relying heavily on unilateral executive action, now face the prospect of being systematically dismantled by the courts. A series of losses at the Supreme Court wouldn't just invalidate specific policies, it would also severely curtail the president's freedom of action. It could potentially force him into a more conventional, more constrained relationship with Congress for getting things done.
A potential check on their whole governing model.
Potentially, yes. And for the United States' international partners. This internal power struggle injects a deep and probably troubling level of uncertainty into American foreign and economic policy. Allies, adversaries alike, they must now question the durability of the administration's commitments and its threats.
Is the U.S. reliable? Can we count on their word?
Exactly. Trade agreements, security partnerships, aid packages, they all seem subject to the outcome of these internal U.S. legal battles. This uncertainty, it might lead allies to hedge their bets, maybe seek more reliable partners, strengthen their own regional blocs, and it might lead adversaries to test American resolve, all of which could create a more volatile, more unpredictable global environment.
Yeah, this really prompts us to ask, when the foundational rules of engagement between the branches of the U.S. government are in flux, as they clearly are now, how does that impact both domestic stability and the global perception of the U.S. as a reliable, predictable power? The events of just these 2 days, they lay bare the profound stress on the American system of checks and balances. And the resolution of these conflicts, however they turn out, will undoubtedly shape our constitutional future in ways we can probably only begin to imagine right now.
Couldn't agree more. And for you, the listener, the practical implication is profound. The resolution of these conflicts, it will determine not just specific policies like tariffs or immigration rules. It will determine the very balance of power that has defined American governance for over 2 centuries. We're living through a period where the foundational rules of the game are being actively redefined. And the outcome will have lasting implications for literally every aspect of American life and for America's standing in the world. #TechTechOutro. So as we wrap up this deep dive into the Federal News Update for Saturday, August 30th, 2025, let's leave you with this thought. In an era where you see executive ambition meeting judicial scrutiny, often alongside legislative silence, what truly becomes the most powerful check on authority? Is it the courts? Or is it perhaps the court of public opinion shaped by those very narratives we discussed earlier?
A critical question to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on the deep dive. We really hope this exploration has given you a clearer, more nuanced understanding of the complex forces shaping our government and our world right now. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and stay well informed.
Indeed. And remember, understanding these complex dynamics, it isn't just some academic exercise. It's essential for navigating our interconnected world, for making informed decisions as citizens. We really encourage you to reflect on these shifts we've discussed and what they might mean for the future of governance and, you know, your own place within it. I'm Sam Kennedy.
And I'm Alex Johnson.
This has been The Deep Dive.